You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Carl Reiner was a writer on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, as well as Sid's second banana on that show. He teamed with Mel Brooks for the classic comedy records, The 2,000-Year-Old Man. Carl Reiner created The Dick Van Dyke Show. He directed The Jerk with Steve Martin. Carl Reiner wrote books and movies and was a loving husband and father. He died on June 29, 2020, at the age of 98. Today, From the Bookshelf remembers Carl Reiner as we listen back to his interviews with me here on the show. Here is Carl Reiner speaking to me on the occasion of his dandy first memoir, I Remember Me.
Love that you use the word dandy. There's only one other person in the world I know used that word. And it was Joe Stein who wrote Fiddler on the Roof and Enter Laughing, the musical and the book. And he used the word dandy when he read my first book, Enter Laughing. And that's a good word. It makes me feel that I'm onto something.
Most performers in comedy, they're either a comic or a straight man. But in your performing career, you were both, and very successfully.
Well, yes. I was more... Actually, I started out as a straight actor, and I thought I was going to be a serious Broadway actor. As a young kid, I went summer theater for two seasons, did 24 plays, went on a Shakespearean repertory tour, and it wasn't until I got in the Army that I got up and started making jokes, because they don't let you put plays on in the Army. And so, so I went to rec halls and got to be funny in the Army. And after I got home and got to be Sid Caesar's straight man on Show of Shows, and went to a college of funny people in that room, the writer's room, with Mel Brooks and Aaron Rubin and Neil Simon, Larry Gelbart. I became funnier every year.
Well, I'm sure you were funny before you got there.
No, I did. There was no question I had a sense of humor. But it honed it, though. I really was honed on that area, in that room.
Had you ever met Mel Brooks before you got into that room?
No. As a matter of fact, I didn't know who the man was. It was my first day on your Show of Shows. We're in the office of Max Liebman, who was the producer, and there was a guy standing there, Mel Brooks. I didn't know his name. It was my first day there, and Sid Caesar was his boss. He didn't work for the show. Sid used to give him $35 a week or something to give him jokes. He was like a pool tumbler, they called it, a guy who made fun. Anyway, he stood up, he was standing there, and he started to do a routine. He talked with this Middle European accent, and he played a Jewish pirate. He became a Jewish pirate who said, he says, you know what they're charging for sailcloth these days? $3.20 a yard. I can't afford to set sail. I can't afford to pillage and rape anymore. And that was the first words out of his mouth. And we, of course, for the next half hour, he just kept on, and it was roaring. The following day, it was a Sunday, and I saw We the People Speak. It was a Sunday program where they recreated the news. They had actors say, last night in Russia, in Stalin's bedroom, there was a plumber working in the toilet, and he heard Stalin say, going to blow the world Thursday. And so I said, hey, fellas, that'd be a good thing to do a satire on. And nobody bought it. So I was trying to prove how funny it was, and I turned to Mel, who was sitting on the couch next to me. I said, here's a man who was at the scene of the crucifixion 2,000 years ago. Isn't that true, sir? And all he said was, oh, boy. And from then on, for the next 10 years, I interviewed him. I said, you knew Jesus? He's this thin lad, right? He wore sandals. He always came into the store, had a candy store, never bought anything, always asked for water. Came into 12 other guys. Anyway, that was the beginning of it. And as I said, to amuse ourselves, or to amuse whoever's around, I get up and ask him the 2,000-year-old man questions. And for 10 years, from 1950... till 1960, we did it at parties, command performance dinners at friends' houses. Get up, fellas, do that thing. And it was at one of these things, and now we had, remember, it's 10 years. We figured it was only for our Jewish friends and our non-anti-Semitic and Gentile friends. That was good, because 5 years after the war, Hitler had decimated the Jews, and we didn't need anybody insulting the Jews anymore, especially ourselves. So, but what happened is that at this party, this party that was a guy named Joe Fields, who was a big Broadway producer, had a party at his house in Beverly Hills, and he invited Mel and I. And there we did our 2,000-year-old man. At the very end, three people came up to us. I remember as if it were yesterday. The first one was George Burns, who I hadn't met yet. Ultimately, I did direct him in Oh God. But here he was with a cigar in his mouth, and he says, "Is there a record on that? You put that on a record?" We said, "No, we have no record." He says, "Put it on a record or I'll steal it." And it was Edward G. Robinson, the famous actor, Broadway and motion picture. He said, "I want to play that man on Broadway. I want to play a 1,000-year-old man on Broadway. Write a play about the 1,000-year-old man." I said, "It's a 2,000-year-old man." "Doesn't matter. I can play any age." I remember him saying that. He actually said that. And it was Steve Martin who really made it possible. Now, Steve was a big talent of finding funny people and putting them on a show. And he wanted nothing more than just to present us, get us out to the world. So he said, "Fellas, I have a studio." He says, "At World Pacific Jazz, where I do my jazz albums." He said, "Why don't you take it over on a weekend?" He said, "It's Saturday night." He said, "Invite some people. Get up and wail." He says, "And whatever you do," he says, "if you don't like it, just burn it." And so we did. We got about a few hundred people, 200 people, and we wailed and did 2 hours worth and cut it down to 47 minutes, and it became the 2,000-year-old man. We weren't even sure that it was good yet. We said, "Who's going to accept the Jewish accent?" This, you know, it was. We were pretty worried about that. And when the album came out, I remember I was doing a movie at Universal. I had just written A Thrill of It All for Doris Day, and my next door neighbor, who had a bunker next door, was Cary Grant. He came by one day. I said, "Cary, he listened to this. We made a funny album, I think." He came back the next day. He says, "Could only have a dozen." I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm taking it to England." I said, "You're going to bring this to England?" He's like, "Speak English there." And so he came back and he said, "She loved it." I said, "Who loved it?" He says, "The Queen and the Queen Mother."
Wow.
He's at Buckingham Palace. "You played this at Buckingham Palace?" And then I said to Mel, I said, "You know," I said, "if the biggest shicks in the world, the female Gentiles, like to wear home free." And, you know, and it was a hit. It did become a hit very soon after.
Well, when I was a little lad, I stuttered terribly. I could hardly get a sentence out. And I also couldn't pronounce my R's, so I was a stutterwo. But I had your record, 2,000 Years, with Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, and I had memorized it. I committed it to memory, and I could recite that record without stuttering. That was my...
Wow! You know, that's the nicest thing. That's the best thing I've ever heard about the record doing for anybody. It did more for us, but it did a lot for you.
Yeah, no, it did a lot for me also. I love the record, and I love not only the 2,000-year-old man, but I also loved the coffee house and all those other routines on the record. And I know that I've heard you say that you never would tell Mel Brooks in advance what questions you would ask. But what about when you were doing the coffee house routine? Did you just make that up as you went along?
Oh, no, everything that we did was at parties. I remember a few times this was a perfect example. I would make them anything I wanted to make them. I would make them I made them an artist once, and I remember saying, "Now, we'll look at that. We're looking at an empty wall." I said, "What? Describe that piece of fine art up there." I said, "Is that an abstract piece of art?" He says, "No, that's an air-conditioned register." Oh, I said, "No, below that, you know." But he fooled me like that many times. But what I remember once, we were in Fire Island, and this fellow, Steve Elliott, had a professional recording studio, and he had a recording in Fire Island. He had a recording studio, and we made a very professional amateur tape there. And I remember while we're doing this tape, a guy walks in. And this guy's uncle, cousin, he was a submarine captain. He had just come back from being in a submarine maneuver. And I said, I immediately said, I made Mel a submarine captain. I said, sir, I understand that you are captain of submarine. And he became a submarine captain. I'll never forget this. I said, is it true, sir? And he didn't know what's coming. That, like in the rest of the Navy, if there's trouble aboard the boat, when you're down there, the submarine captain stays down. He's no. Well, you're already down there. We go up. They come down. We go up. Anyway, he immediately found the fun in anything I asked him. And the thing is that what made it so funny is that when we were asked once to go to, we got a paying gig to go to, I write about this, in San Francisco at the Cow Palace, two performances at 8 and 10. They paid us an awful lot of money, and we were going to do selections from our record, because we had to make sure that they got something for their money. But we couldn't stay with that. I must ask Mel questions that he doesn't know he's going to get, because he's twice as funny when he doesn't know what. When I ask him a question of something he's done before, it's more leaden. He's looking for it, and it's never as funny as he does it the first time. So I was always giving him questions he didn't know were coming. And I'll never forget going up there. He was aware that I was going to do that. And he says, he was complaining. He said, I'm never going to do this again. He said, you're not going to talk me into this again. No, sir. He was so upset. And I realized what it was. I knew he was going to score big, because whatever I threw up at him, he knocked down. He really did well. But he didn't know he was going to come up with an answer to a question he heard for the first time. So he was less sanguine about it than I was. Anyway, we killed him at two shows, all the prepared stuff that we did from the record, most of it new stuff. And when we came down, we're riding in a car going in a limo to the airport. I said, Mel, he's not talking. I said, Mel, how much money would you have taken knowing the kind of reaction you would have gotten? And he said, $14. That bleach, he would have said, no, I'll do it for nothing. But $14 is funnier.
Yeah. It's a funnier number, 14.
Yeah.
Well, you once, when you were on the Sid Caesar show, you once were struggling to find the funniest number.
Oh, yeah, that's a... there was Imogene Coca was going to break the bank at Monte Carlo, and she was going to place it on one number and keep winning until the bank was broken. That was a sketch. And we said, well, we got to have a funny number. Everything in the sketch has to be funny. The actors have to be funny. The words have to be funny. And the numbers have to be funny. So this is absolutely true. All these great writers, these wonderful writers, paid a lot of money. They're all suggesting numbers. 41, 16, 69, which is natural to somebody to say. Can't say that.
That's right.
Anyway, 21. How about 51? Anyway, it went on for almost an hour. and every number that was tried was said, Imogene Coca would try it. And we said, no, it's not working. And then somebody said, and we don't know who said it, said 32. And said, say it, Imogene. And she said, 32. And for some reason, we all laughed. And 32 became the number. And just what we did in the office, when the audiences heard 32, they laughed too.
Who knew that there was a number funnier than another number?
Yes.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're listening back this week to my interviews with the late Carl Reiner, who died on June 29th at the age of 98.
Do you think your background as a legitimate actor served you well as a straight man? I think a straight man has to be a good actor to be.
Oh, there's no question about it. A straight man is a guy who makes believe he doesn't know that what is funny. You know, he has to. He's what the audience is. He is works for the audience. He asks the funny man what they would want to hear him ask, what they would ask if they were up there.
We're talking to Carl Reiner, and his new book is called I Remember Me. In fact, we're talking to me, because he's the author of I Remember Me. I've often heard that the great Al Jolson, who was the world's greatest entertainer, according to Al Jolson, was kind of an asshole. But now your book, I Remember Me, also tells me that his rival, his arch rival, George Jessel, was also possibly an asshole.
Well, he was not anywhere near as big an asshole as... Jolson won the prize hands down.
Oh yeah.
Oh, but Jessel, first play I was ever in after the war was a thing called Call Me Mister. Call Me Mister was a musical review, and I played it all over the country, in Chicago for 6 months, in Boston for 3 months, and we came out to the West Coast to play it at the Biltmore Theater, which no longer exists. And at the opening night, it was a very big opening, and as I'm going to the, the following day I go to my agent's office, and I'm walking to the parking lot to get my car after visiting my agent, and a call comes in. Somebody says, they chase after me. They said, get to a radio quickly because there's somebody going to come on and review something you should hear. So I was in the parking lot of Shaq's, the office, and I said, can I use your radio? Tune it on to 790, whatever it was. And there it was, this guy, George Fisher, who was a reporter then, a TV reporter. I mean, a radio reporter. He said, last night I saw a play at the Biltmore Theater starring a young actor, and he proceeded to give me a review that I sounded like Jesus Christ. I mean, it was the best review any human being could get. He not only said it, my name, he says, and I'll spell it for you. He spelled C-I-R-R-E-I. If Mr. Reiner is listening to this program, call George Jessel at 20th Century Fox. There's a big, fat contract waiting for you on his desk at this moment. Now, George Jessel, who was a comedian and an actor and a producer, was now the head of 20th Century Fox making movies, green-lighting big movies. And, of course, I went up there the next day. I called him immediately, and I never forgot his words. I said, this is Carl Reiner. You told me to call. He said, Carl Reiner? Oh, yes. He said, I don't want to make a big chimus. Chimus is a Jewish dish made on a Friday night. It takes a lot of work. It's potatoes and prunes in it, and it takes a lot of cooking. He said, I don't want to make a big chimus. Come over tomorrow, Monday, and he says, at 10 o'clock, and I'll come to my office. And I do it. I come to his office, 10 o'clock, sit there, wait for him to come out. I'm in the outer office with the secretary. He comes out once. He talks to the secretary, never looks at me. As he passes by, without looking at me, he squeezes my arm. He says, I'll see you in a minute, kid, and walks into the office. He comes out a second time and doesn't talk to me. And this time he has his hand raised. And as he walks back to his office, I wonder why his hand is raised. He was kissing the little mezuzah, which is the little prayer scroll that a Jew has on his door. He wanted me to notice that he was kissing the religious icon. Anyway, then he said, come in my office. Well, in his office, I'm waiting he's got a big fat contract he promised me. Well, for the next hour or 20-30 minutes, he shows me every picture on the wall that's inscribed to him from every president, every senator extant, plus every star that ever worked at the 20th Century Fox made to him. And then he sits me down. He gives me a picture of Lana Turner. He says, would you like this picture of Lana Turner? I said, I said, sure. And so he autographs Lana Turner's picture.
Oh, that was nice of him.
Yeah, and he puts two little crosses on her bosom, and he's noticed the lovely tits on her. I mean, that's the classy man that he was.
That's great.
Now I'm
man.
Sitting there, and he's taking calls from Europe, and I'm waiting for him to talk to me. And I'll never forget this. He gets a call, and he's about to talk to me, and Paris is calling. He's, oh, Paris, I'm doing a picture in Paris. He says that those idiots, they can't make a decision. They call me for every decision. And it was the director. He listened, and he said, sure, they're both worries. He said, they can't make a decision. I have to make it for them. He said, there were two endings to a movie. They want to know which ending to shoot. So I told him, do it both. They can't make a decision, and he couldn't either. And so, but he's proud of himself. He's proud of himself in berating them. Anyway, now I'm sitting there waiting for him to say what I'm going to do. The phone rings again, and he picks it up, and he says, yes. Oh, wait a minute, he says. I've got an actor sitting in my office right across from me. He says, yes. He's perfect for the part. He'll knock shit out of it. Great actor. And he holds the phone. He says, when does it shoot? He's okay. He says, I got a great part for you in a movie. He says, how long are you going to be here in Los Angeles? I said, well, I go up to San Francisco tomorrow for 2 weeks. He says, I'll be in San Francisco for 2 weeks. Oh, I see. He's okay. Sorry, kid. He said, I need you right away. Maybe next time. And with that, he hangs up the phone and ushers me out of the office. And no contract, nothing.
Wait a minute. But you got your picture of Lana Turner.
I got my picture. But what it was, I realized that after, what it was, he wanted to have George Fisher, the columnist, the radio columnist, say, Georgie Jessel found a great star and he's going to make a big fat contract. He wanted his name. He connected himself to a hit show downtown, found a star that he's going to make a star out of. Anyway, that was the story.
So now, you mentioned earlier, just out of comparison, that Steve Allen had offered his studio for you to record The 2,000-Year-Old Man. What did Steve Allen get out of that?
Nothing. He just got the pleasure that's what Steve was. Steve did that all the time. He was one of the dearest, sweetest men and cared more about getting comedy out to the world, no matter who did it. No, he wanted nothing from us. He told us right away, he says, I'm not your partner. He says, I just want you guys to do this.
It's amazing, isn't it? There's both. I guess you run into both kinds. You run into all kinds in what you people in show business call show business.
Yes, I know.
In your new book, I Remember Me, it's full of stories about your family. And you mentioned that you have a nephew named Shapiro, which is my name. And your nephew teaches at CSUMB, and I teach at Monterey Peninsula College. It's right across the street from CSUMB. I could be your nephew.
Well, I will. I'll take you on as a pseudo-nephew.
I'll be an honorary nephew. And speaking of your family, your wonderful wife, you guys were married a long time. She's someone we all love. Not only was she a singer and an entertainer, but she is has one of the most famous quotes in the history of movies.
Yes, and Robbie Reiner, who's her firstborn, was making a movie called Harry and Sally in New York, and he called his mother. He said, Ma, I have a line. I want you to come to New York and say this line. And she said, wait a minute. She said, a million actors in New York were women act. He said, why don't you get one of them? He said, Ma, nobody can say it like you. And then flew to New York, and that's that scene where they do a mock orgasm, faking an orgasm, and then Sal has the line, I'll have what she's having. And it became an iconic line. You know, the AFI and WABC decided to pick out the 10 greatest lines ever done in movies, and they culled it down to 5, and there it is. Like, there's, Rhett Butler with Clark Gable, Frankly, Madam, I Don't Give a Damn, Clint Eastwood, Make My Day, Marlon Brando, I Made Him an Offer He Can't Refuse, and Humphrey Bogart saying, this could be the start of something big. And Estelle Reiner is number 4, and I titled the chapter, Estelle Reiner, One Better Than Humphrey Bogart. Now, I also talk about the fact that Robbie wanted Estelle to do that because she had the ability to say funny things in short bursts, and she invented one that I mentioned in the book. When my daughter Annie was 16 years old, her brother Robbie suggested when she was wondering what to get for a 16th birthday present, he said, why don't you get what your friends got in Beverly Hills, a nose job, rhinoplasty. Everybody in Beverly Hills said, yeah, that little turned up nose, they had any kind of a bump on it. And I said, wait a minute, Rob. Your mother is a bigger nose than Annie, and look at the handsome guy she got. And Estelle said, yes, it's not the size of your nose that counts. It's what's in it. And I was doing the jerk with Steve Martin at the time, and I told him the line. And 10 years later, he calls the home, and he says, can I talk to Estelle? And I said, what do you want? He said, let me talk to her. And he put her on, and he said, remember that line you said? He said, can I use it? And there it is. He was doing Roxanne at the time, and he's playing Cyrano, and there's Cyrano saying, it is not the size of your nose that counts, it's what's in it. So Roxanne is turning in his grave.
I hope your wife got a writing credit on that
Oh, she's getting credit right now. She passed away 4 or 5 years ago, but her talent lingers on in her paintings and her children and her albums. She's done 5 great jazz albums. She was an extraordinary woman.
You know, when you guys were first married, of course you know, but I wonder if our listeners know, when you were first married, you were working as a writer and a second banana on a comedy show, and that was in Manhattan, although you lived in New Rochelle, you
right.
commuted, and you had a little place, and you had children, a wife. It sounds like a television series, I remember, when I was a kid.
Well, that's exactly how it became a television series. No, I was, after I did the show of shows, I was asked to do, they were offering me situation comedies. The review format disappeared for a long time until Carol Burnett resurrected and brilliantly, and then SNL came about. But for many years, there were no more reviews, and I was offered situation comedies. I read a few, and they weren't very good. And my wife said, "Why don't you write one?" And I never thought of writing a situation comedy. I never did it. But I was remembering that I was on, to this day, I remember exactly where I got the idea. I was on the East Side Drive, the Franklin Roosevelt Drive, and I asked myself the question. I recommend people talk to themselves. I said, if you're smart and you ask yourself a question, you may get a smart answer. I said, what piece of ground, I call myself Reiner. Reiner, what piece of ground do you stand on? Nobody else stands on. I said, well, live in New Rochelle with a wife, kids. I travel to New York every day and work at a variety show, a musical variety show. And I said, I'll write about that. I'll write about the home life of a guy who goes to town, talks about his wife and children when he's in the writer's office, and when he's home, he talks, when he's in the writer's room, he talks about his home. And so that's exactly it. I wrote a thing called Head of the Family, and then Peter Lawford was going to finance my doing a pilot, and I wrote 13 episodes to make sure I had a good Bible for whatever writers come after me, and I did the pilot. It was just okay. It was fair with Barbara Britton and Morty Gunty and Sylvia Miles, wonderful actors, but it wasn't good enough. And I went on my way. I started writing movies for Universal, and I get a call one day. I had an agent who was very bothered with the fact that there were 13 episodes of a very good series potential lying fallow on his desk. So he called in Sheldon Leonard and Danny Thomas, who was producing shows then, and he said he gave them to Sheldon, read them, and he called me in, and I said, Sheldon, I said, I'm sorry, I did this, and I don't want to fail twice with the same material. And Sheldon said, and this is a pretty good impression, you won't fail because I'll get a better actor to play you. and he suggested Dick Van Dyke. I went to see him in Bye Bye Birdie, and there was maybe the most talented man that ever was in a situation comedy, ever. The man could do anything you ask of him.
How much was Alan Brady like Sid Caesar?
Not an iota. Sid Caesar was a pussycat. 9 years with Sid on Caesar's Hour and shows. Went to lunch every day for 9 years, and those were sometimes 39 weeks a year. And that character, when you're writing when you want a hero to be heroic, you get a really good villain. Mm-hmm. So we have to have the boss. The boss is always somebody who puts down his worker. So we needed that. And I made an amalgam of 3 guys. One was Milton Berle, who was very nasty to writers and everybody. He blew his whistle and shouted. He wasn't nasty to writers, but he was an impossible guy to work with. The nasty guy was Jackie Gleason, who had a show, and he never spoke to his writers. They wrote the sketches, and when they delivered them, he wouldn't talk to them. He had them slip them under the, or wouldn't open the hotel door. They'd slip them under the door. Second one, and then was a show on Broadway with Phil Silvers called Top Banana, which was an embodiment of these kind of terrible guys. Phil was the prototype of a bad, boss comedian. And so I amalgamed those 3, and he became Alan Brady, and I played that part.
And so well. And now, by the way, in that show, I think you were the first actor ever to kind of acknowledge that you wore a toupee.
Yeah, well, that came about because I when I got a toupee very early in my well, when it started to go, nobody knew I was wearing a toupee, but I couldn't not tell people. I always told people. When I was on the Carson show, he said, "You look good tonight." I said, "It's the toupee, it's not me." And everybody knew. As a matter of fact, on his show once, I took it off and put it on the desk. No, I said, when they asked me, you know, it was Frederick Murray who said he always wore his toupee, but he said he came to me at a big event once. I was wearing my toupee. He said, "How do you decide when to wear it and when not to wear it?" I says, "Well, when I wear a tuxedo and I want to feel dressed up and be a little handsomer, I wear a toupee. When I want to go about my business, I don't want to be encumbered by having to put a thing on my head." So I always told people when they told me I look good, and I'll tell them it's the toupee.
Well, I hope you're wearing it today.
No, I haven't worn it in years.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're listening back this week to my interviews with the late Carl Reiner, who died on June 29th at the age of 98. Among the many books that Carl Reiner authored was Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born, a history of that great sitcom. And in that book, there is a beautiful photograph of Mary Tyler Moore that I was asking Carl Reiner about.
Yeah, that's funny. We had to find that picture, and it's in the archives, Smithsonian or something. We couldn't find it, so that is a photocopied one of the Look magazine of that year. We stuck her figure in it.
Now, in your book, you talk about Rose Marie being sort of upset about that.
Yes, yeah, that was very true. Rose Marie and I had a problem the first year because she was told it was a program about three writers who write for a television show, and actually it's about three writers who write for a television show whose original thrust is in his home life at home, and somebody explained it to her wrong, and she was waiting for, you know, most of the activity took place in the 49 Better Bonnie Meadow Road, and so she had that in her craw, for she was always thinking she didn't have enough to do that first year. And then when it came that they used her Mary Tyler Moore's cover picture on the cover, she said to me, "Why do you always keep pushing me?" I said, and that this is absolutely true. The second year, when we were ready to get, she, by the way, Rosemary, there's nobody better as an actress. I said to Rosemary, we have to meet at the our agent's office, and I said, "Unless you can come to the realization that it's not me, but the world, the men in this world would prefer seeing," and I mentioned those three parts, her legs, her tits, and her ass. Actually, I use a much more ugly word for private parts, just to make sure she knew I was dead serious. I said, "If you can't accept that, has nothing to do with me. If you can't accept that, then we can't." And she accepted it, and for the next year, we were dear friends, and we remain so for now for 60 years.
Baby Rose Marie, she was a star when she was a little tiny girl.
She was a star at 4 years of age. I read her book. It's one of the saddest biographies you'll ever read. Her father was a monster. Her father managed her. And her mother and she lived, they were divorced. Her mother and she lived in a one-room apartment. One room was a bedroom, kitchen, toilet, everything in that one room. And her husband took the $80 she got each week for doing one little show when she was 4 years old, and lived in an absolutely, you know, nice home. Hmm. And it's one of the saddest things. That poor woman, she was a star at four. She had her picture on the Variety cover when she was six. She never stopped being, and her voice was the same at four as it was when she became an adult.
Right, she sang like Sophie Tucker when she was just a little tiny thing.
I know, and they're recordings of her, you can't believe them.
Yeah, and well, it's interesting that you cast a woman as the writer, because I'm looking in your book, there's this wonderful picture of the writing staff of the Sid Caesar Show, and Mel Brooks has got that pipe in his pocket.
Yeah, right, but the truth of the matter is on the original Caesar, on the original show of shows, there was a writer, Lucille Callan, and Mel Tolkien, two Canadians. They were members of Max Liebman's staff at Tamamet when they worked there. When he came to do the shows. He took both of them with him. And Lucille Callan was with us for a number of years until Sid and Imogene broke up, and Imogene went to have her own show on another network. And that's when Lucille went with Imogene, and that was the last we seen. But we wanted to people our new writing room with somebody who had the feminine view, and we had another woman writer. Selma Diamond was in the cast.
She was wonderful.
One of the writers, a very funny woman. And so that's why Rosemary was cast. We always had a woman's attitude in the office.
Dick Van Dyke, he's a guy whose his comedy is very physical. He's really tied into his torso and how he moves. He's like a silent comedian. I remember, in fact, when he had a series later, he always had a silent sequence in that.
Well, you know, I did a movie with him called The Comic, which was maybe the best acting you'll ever see. Dick Van Dyke is a consummate artist. He's not only an actor, a dancer, a singer, a banjo player. He can do anything. He really can do anything. He's an extraordinary talent. And when he did the Dick Van Dyke Show, his glibness, I mean, his ability to learn a line and turn it into something gold was inspirational for me. I love writing for Dick. And to this day, he is the single most talented human being I've ever worked with. Well, Mel Brooks, as far as funny, there's nobody funnier in the whole world than Mel Brooks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's funny. And you're funny.
I'm not too bad.
We're chatting with Carl Reiner. His latest book is Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Like, I was watching the episode that you put the script in, sorry, The Attempted Marriage, and there's so much physical stuff that Dick Van Dyke does. How would that have been different? I mean, did you take those 13 scripts and rework them entirely for the cast that you had?
Oh, yes. The original 13 scripts were one-camera shows, and I had to write them for three cameras, which means that we were going to do it in sequence for an audience. The other one was done in pieces, and it was a revelation because it was so wonderful. To hear the audience laughter, capture their laughter, and not add any laughter. As a matter of fact, our laugh trap was captured by a guy named Charlie Douglas, who used to work on our show when we sort of cut off a scene abruptly. There would be a cutoff of a laugh. You'd ha, and it would stop. He would trickle it off with a ha. And that's all he did for us. But he loved a laugh track so much that he put it in his machine and he used it on other one-camera shows so that our laugh was heard. As a matter of fact, I wrote about it, Barbara Vane, who later became an actor on our show and became, you know, Mission Impossible. She was Cinnamon Carter. She was brilliant. She used to come to all our earlier shows and laugh out loud. So I used to tell people that Barbara Bain is laughing on shows. You'll hear her laughing on shows she's never seen because she was all these other shows.
So when we're watching Get Smart, we're really hearing the laugh track from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yes.
You know, you have this marvelous ear for dialogue. You know, the dialogue sounds so natural. When I was reading it on the page, it was hard to believe that anybody had written it because it seems to flow out of the actors so naturally.
I know. That was the trick of it. I said, to make it fancy, and one of the things I assiduously did was not use any slang. So the fact that I knew this, we were doing something very special. I knew it would last. And look, we're still playing it on television every night because it sounds, you know, it sounds human. And I said, only write about who you are and what you are. I mean, we writers are no different than the audience. We feel the same. We get angry. We get jealous. We do all the things that everybody does. So just write about yourself, and you'll be touching into everybody else's lives.
Do you think a lot about what makes something funny? I mean, you don't have a lot of. There's not a lot of jokes per se in Van Dyke Show.
No, the jokes are. Actually, we had a guy, the human joke machine was Maury Amstutz. Anytime we needed a real joke, he would come up with it. He was called the human joke machine, and he had a show. He had a nightclub on Broadway where he used to get up and you throw him a subject. He'd throw jokes back on the subject. So, no, but I wrote wittily, but not with jokes. I couldn't write jokes.
in your original pilot, the head of the family pilot, the character that Maury Amsterdam eventually played was a much younger guy.
Yes, because I was thinking of Mel Brooks. He was in the writer's room of the show of shows. Mel Brooks was the young writer, the youngest of the bunch. So I wanted to have a young writer, but then when Rosemary was the first one I cast, and she said the natural for this would be Maury Amsterdam. I thought he was too old, but then when I thought of getting him, where I'd seen on, you know, in New York on Broadway, I said that would be a plus. And so I forgot the fact that I needed a young guy there. I'd rather have an old guy who really, he really delivered for us.
The idea of Pickles, that's a good, Pickles is my favorite name, but to have a wife named Pickles.
Yeah, it was an invention I had. That I didn't have enough room to see her, so we wrote about her. He talked about her a lot. And when we finally did see her, we found a very good actress to play her, Joan London.
When you finally sold the Dick Van Dyke Show, you had to move to California, or were you already in California?
I think by that time I was in California, but I didn't go back. That's right, I didn't go back. I came out to do the Dinah Shore Show, a television show that I wrote, and every other week I was on it as a performer. As a matter of fact, that was my favorite calling card credit. It was written by Charles Isaacs and Carl Reiner. Every week you saw that credit. And when I was on the show, it said, usually I would have a special guest. Our special guest was Yves Montand that week. And I was billed as, and your not-so-special guest, Carl Reiner, the not-so-special guest. I loved that.
So you moved your family from,
yes,
New Rochelle, California.
Yeah, they were, my children were 12 and 14 at the time.
Was that a traumatic move, or were you ready for
it? It was, because they had moved from the Bronx to New Rochelle. That was the first move, and we lived there for about 5 years, and they had to move again and get new friends. And when you're 12 years old, you have really good friends, and they had to find new friends out here, and they did, but it was not easy for them.
What about for you and your wife?
Well, it wasn't for us, because we mainly wanted to make our kids happy. But very quickly, they melded in here. Then we had a child out here, and once you have a child in a certain place, then you have put a foot down, you planted your flag, you know. And
around the time of the Dick Van Dyke Show, I just so happens the other day I was watching TV, and I was watching the Judy Garland Show.
Yes.
And you were a guest. You were sitting with Judy Garland.
Yeah, I love, dude. I ever love her. I tweeted this once, that she is the single most talented human being I've ever worked with, saw, or enjoyed. She just could, there's nothing about her that wasn't perfect. She was a perfect performer. I remember two things. I don't know if I did it on the show, but I know I did it maybe in a dressing room, but I said, we talked about the same being the same age. I think on the show she said, "What she in the dressing room?" She says, "We were both 37 at the time." She says, "Isn't this a shitty age?" I said, "What are you talking about?" She says, "Well, 38 is a nice round number. It's, you're getting close to 40, which isn't one everyone wants to reach." But it's and then she, I said, "It's like the in between age when you sang a song. I'm just Mr. In Between," and she was in love with Clark Gable or somebody, yeah, and sang to his picture. I said, "You're doing it again." Anyway, but I told her, I said, "When you were 13, you sang a thing called Balboa in a movie. I forgot the name of the movie. And I fell in love with you. I was 13. I said, "That's the cutest person I've ever seen." And I said, "It remained thus." I said, "I've never not loved you." And she's, too bad we couldn't have met then.
It was a gem to see you.
No, I think one of the shows, she had two shows. One of them, she says, "Talk with celebrities." I said, "I don't really belong here." She goes, "Why not?" I said, "Well, I'm not really a celebrity." She said, "You are." And she tried to convince me I was. I said, "No, I go on the street, nobody wants to kiss me, or, you know, like Sinatra, don't chase after me." And I try to downplay myself, and she tried to convince me I was a celebrity.
Well, you've known a lot of legendary performers in your career, including Mark Twain, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, in my book, I think that's the funniest thing I have. One of the funniest things. You know, when you have a book, you always look for somebody some important person like Larouche Foucault or Oscar Wilde to put in at the beginning, you know, a little quote of theirs. And so I quoted this wonderful quote. It says here, after 4 hours at the wheel of the Mississippi paddle boat transporting folks to their homes, I am afforded no greater pleasure than retiring to my stateroom, turning on my new RCA Victor 7-inch television set, and watching Carl Reiner's hilarious The Dick Van Dyke Show. Mark Twain. And then I have a picture, actually, my... That was a set we had, a 7-inch set, and I have a picture of it on the other side.
That was very nice of Mark Twain to come back from the dead and write you a blurb on you.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark Twain is my favorite thing, my favorite writer in the whole world ever. You know, as a matter of fact, as Huckleberry Finn, it's been said that the novel didn't exist before that was the definitive novel, American novel. Hmm. And after that, everybody came and said, oh, yeah, that's how you do it.
Talking with Carl Reiner, whose books include God Bless You is for Both Sneezing and Farting. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We were talking earlier about what makes things funny. Do you think you learned from Mark Twain or other writers how to craft humor?
I think I learned that from two things have to happen. There's a funny bone born in some people that is just lays there and doesn't do anything unless there's an outside influence, and usually your conditioning is your family, your mother, your father. And my mother and father loved comedians, and they used to take me to the movies when I was kids. We always went on a Saturday, and I remember seeing the Marx Brothers, the Ritz Brothers, and Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, of course, and laughing was a priority. And then we'd listen to the radio and listen to the Jack Benny Show, the Fred Allen Show, the Joe Penna Show, anything that had comedy in it. And that's where you hone your thing. It's your background. And if you have a funny bone, it develops.
You had a lot of radio actors or kind of actors from that era that you found parts for on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Well, yeah, there was one season where I decided I was going to do a tribute to the radio actors. And that was a wonderful time on the set, because I had three of them. You know, it's funny. When I was 13 years old, I listened to a radio program called the Rudy Valley Show. And on it, he said he was going to have an impersonator. I loved impersonators. And then on comes this impersonator. His name is Richard Hyden, impersonating a guy named Edwin Karp. And he says, I don't impersonate people. I impersonate fish. I would like to do for you now. This is radio. I'm listening to this when I'm 13. I would like to do now the sound of the yellow mountain trout. He makes a sound so inaudible to the human ear that you can't hear it. Listen carefully. And then for 1 minute, there was no sound. And I'm laughing hysterically. I'm 13. I never forgot that. And when I got to be an adult and I'm doing the Van Dyke Show, I said, I've got to recreate that moment. And I had Richard Hyden. And there's a picture in the book of Richard Hyden with his mouth agape, making no sound, the sound of the yellow mountain trout. Oh, just no sound. But having Richard on the show and doing his wonderful poems. I mean, it was the best week of my life.
It's a wonderful show, and there's so many episodes. You know, nowadays they only do about 24 episodes a season or something, or 23, or 13. And
no, we did 35 to 37 episodes a season. We have 158 in all, and, you know, it's funny because the first couple of years I was writing by myself for about 3 years, and I was, you know, I laugh today when I see it. We did a show that was 28 and a half minutes long and 15 seconds for a perfect public service announcement. I was always fighting for 5-10 seconds to do a tag, and you know, to get my whole show in beginning, middle, and end and tag. And today I'm looking at the shows, and they're down from 27-8 minutes to 20 minutes. They're down from 22. This was because... I thank Ronald Reagan for it. He did. He said, no, the airwaves belong to anybody who wants to advertise, instead of what Herbert Hoover said, that belongs to the people.
Ronald Reagan gave it to the advertisers so that 28-minute shows went down to 20 minutes. Now you can see Viagra and Cheese Whiz all in the same 10 seconds. You can see one after another. One after another. If you like commercials, you can. But I'm very upset about that part of the. What were we talking about right before that? I wanted to say something else.
Oh, we were talking about the actors that you had on the show.
But yes, when any time we had a chance to use a wonderful actor, I remember on the show when I did the tribute to the radio actors, we had Burt Gordon, the Mad Russian.
Oh, yeah.
And Arlene Harris, the Chatterbox. Yeah. Oh, I always was so happy when we got there was one show called I'm No Henry Walden, and we got a famous actor from Orson Welles' theater, Everett Sloan, to play. And I was thrilled. I was almost ashamed to ask him. I said, and he was so thrilled to do it. And he was so nice about it. And it was so sad because he committed suicide at 57 because he lost his memory and his sight, and he figured it doesn't pay to hang around anymore. But he did the show a few years before that. I was so sad to read about that.
He was a fine actor.
He was, really.
I want to ask you just about the directors in the show. John Rich, who I guess was the first director of the...
He was the first director, and he set the show on it. He had done a lot of three-camera shows. He was like the guy to go to anybody want to do a three-camera show. And he did so well for us that we kept him on for the first, I don't know, five dozen shows. And then one of our actors, Jerry Helper, wanted to become a director. And luckily he was on all those shows, and he carefully monitored what John had done. And Jerry even did more shows than John, ultimately. So we had wonderful direction always.
And I associated John Rich with All in the Family.
Yes, right.
He did many seasons, if not all of the seasons, of All in the Family.
Right.
You know, it's a great show, and I know you said that you knew you were doing something special, that it would last. But did you ever think, wow, you know, now you can get them all on Blu-ray. They look better than they ever looked.
I know. You know, somebody colored Lucy's show, and they sent to me a couple of cells of our show colored. Boy, it really looks great in color, but... At the time, we decided not to go in color because it would cost $67,000 or whatever it was a show, and it wouldn't put us in the red. So we said leave it in black and white, but it seems to be doing very well in black and white.
I particularly like black and white. What can I say? I think black and white looks great.
I do, too, and when I see old movies in black and white. As a matter of fact, this week I just taped a coming movie, Maurice Chevalier in The Merry Widow.
Oh, I love that. That's an Ernst Lubitsch picture, I believe.
Ernst Lubitsch was the man. Boy, was he great.
Yeah. I love those. There's something weird about those Chevalier, Jeanette MacDonald movies. Chevalier is kind of a strange comedian.
He was a strange cat. I saw him on Broadway. He was very charming, but he was a strange human being. He was our entree to the French lover. He was the only one doing movies in America from France at that time.
He did a good French accent.
Oh yes,
not as good as yours, but his was okay.
In the army, they sent me to Georgetown University to learn to be a French interpreter. So I learned French, and they sent me to Hawaii, where they speak very little French.
Now, you actually speak French? I thought you just fake
speak. No, je peux parler français. I can speak French, but I can also double talk in French. But the master double talker was Sid Caesar. He could double talk in any language. It was extraordinary. It was like a violinist playing. He was so good at it.
Carl Reiner, his latest book is called Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. It's a fabulous book. It was the greatest sitcom of all time. And Carl Reiner, it's been such a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for allowing me to talk about it, because I'm so proud of it, and I want to get into people's hands, through your mouth to people's hands.
Well, I'll do my best for you.
Okay.
I made your last book a bestseller, didn't I?
You absolutely did. I will come to you with my next one, which is called Me at 93, which I'm working on right now.
Oh, fantastic. I can't wait. I'm going to put it on my shelf right next to God Bless You is for both sneezing and farting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, that one is coming out now with illustrations. In about 6 months, James Bennett is putting out, is doing the final touches on the colored illustrations, and it's going to be a winner. By the way, at the very beginning, I added this to the book. It's called You Say God Bless You for Sneezing and Farting. And I checked this out on Google. Mine is not the first fart book. The first, there were 25 books on farting. The first one was written in 1723 or 1774, something like 1730, by Benjamin Franklin. I bought it. I paid $15 for it. It's a perfect little book. It's called Fart Proudly, and there's a picture of Benjamin Franklin on the cover. Since then, they found out that repressing a fart is very unhealthy for your system because you're getting rid of gases that shouldn't be festering there, and if you keep them, you're not doing your system well. So farting is healthy.
Fart proudly, said Benjamin Franklin.
Okay.
Oh, Carl Reiner, thank you so much. It's really wonderful to speak to you again, and I look forward to getting a chance to speak to you next time.
Thank you so much for your time.
We've been listening back to the great Carl Reiner. He passed away last month at the age of 98. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.